Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, I think we're roughly 13 days out, midterm elections.
More or less.
The president is going to be on the trail, we are told, 10 rallies, at least 10 rallies between now and Tuesday, November 6th.
That's a lot of Pinocchios if you're keeping fact checks at home. This has gotten to a stage, John. I mean, we've talked a lot about this president and his casual relationship with the truth, but it has been literally impossible to keep track with the utter falsehoods that have been uttered by the president in the run-up to this election. And one thing that strikes me, just thinking about it, that he did this in 2016 to some degree, but you had a lot of Republicans running their own races. This has been a case where President Trump has been leading the way, and you have a whole lot of Republicans following right behind him, drafting behind him, and talking about the same sort of things he is.
It's like that old Hunter S. Thompson book, Fear and Lying in Washington, D.C.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
No. What was it? It was something like that.
And our
friend Frank Bruni, columnist for the New York Times, has said that the Republican strategy going into the end is fear and lies. Now, I don't want to go that far, but it's clear that the president has been saying some very scary things. We've got terrorists streaming across the border. We've got Democrats who want to take away your coverage of pre-existing conditions. We've got a lot of things that just really, again, I don't like to use the word lies, but things that just either are not true or there is absolutely no evidence or are greatly exaggerated.
Yeah, and I think you add it to the uncertainty of this midterm election where Democrats are running their playbook and they feel good about where they stand with their base and their issue set. And Republicans, led by President Trump, are running an entirely different campaign, often because of the president and his megaphone, based on entirely different facts or non-facts or falsehoods. That is, I think, what's been set up. And I think you see it with this caravan heading through Mexico, hundreds and hundreds of miles away from the border. The president has gone very far in suggesting that Democrats are behind it.
He's got a wingman on this. I don't know if you've seen this, but Mike Pence.
Yeah.
Who's also been out there, and he tends to echo the president from time to time. But listen to this. This is Pence with a little assist at the end from the president about the caravan.
The caravan that's now making its way through Mexico, headed for the southern border, was organized by leftist organizations and financed by Venezuela. As we've said...
And the Democrats, maybe?
The Democrats are financing the in Venezuela. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember when statements from the president, vice president, or other officials, these are official statements. This is from the top leadership of the executive branch, that if there wasn't sufficient backing or evidence to back them up, would become a major issue in town. This just kind of like flies by. But there was a very interesting exchange, Rick, in the Oval Office yesterday, where the president was basically asked, "You're saying that there are these Middle Easterners, implying they're terrorists, And we'll take a listen.
But no proof that they're in the caravan.
Well,
now.
They could very well be.
But there's no proof.
There's no proof of anything. But they could very well be.
So in other words, Rick, he's saying there very well might be. But that's a very interesting statement that he said at the end. This may be one of the most interesting things I've heard the president say. He said there is no proof of anything.
Profound.
I haven't heard that kind of statement since I was back at Vassar College and we were doing postmodernism and we were talking about how the truth is simply a construct of those the power elite. Wow.
I got an A+ in logic in college, I'll tell you that.
Did you really?
Where'd
you go to school?
Very proud of that. Listeners know. I don't need to.
Yeah.
But I think there's a glibness to that answer, but I think also a profundity to what the president is saying there. Because he is acting as if there are no facts, and that is the world that he constructs. And on this one, it's an interesting thing to go back and look. The New York Times, I think, had a good dissection of his comments about these Middle Easterners. I believe it was, it talked about this in response to you and your colleagues out on the White House lawn the other day, where he said, you know, take your cameras in there. You'll find them. You'll find these Middle Easterners. You'll find MS-13. And, of course, we've been in these traveling.
Matt Gutman's been there, and he's been on the lookout. Yeah.
And he finds, heart-wrenching stories of poverty and oppression and violence from home countries. He is not finding Middle Easterners. Then you saw an entire administration scramble to try to find Middle Easterners.
Well might be.
But there was then an effort, I think, multiple people in the administration trying to say, look, yes, there are people of Middle Eastern descent, and they're citing obscure reports, and they start talking about terrorists apprehended at the border, which has nothing to do with this. And then the president ends up coming full circle after 48 hours of his whole White House trying to find proof for what the president is asserting. He comes out and says, well, maybe not.
Well, on the Middle Eastern thing, I was pointed to this morning. I'm being serious here. I was pointing to somebody saying that there were some reports out of Guatemala, you know, where they crossed the border, that there were a group of Bangladeshis.
Right.
But then I looked at my map, and I don't know if you guys, our listeners, I know we're a very intelligent group of podcast, millions of you out there. But if you look at a map, Bangladesh, I don't know. I don't know.
I've never even heard that. I cannot imagine.
Well done, Trevor. Trevor gets the president in there. I think, and clearly what the president was trying to do there, he wasn't suggesting people that may have Middle Eastern relatives at some point. He was suggesting that terrorists are infiltrating this band of refugees and trying to gain access and about to gain access to the United States, and that he was the only one standing in the way of Democrats making that happen.
So let me run through quick. And by the way, we're going to be talking in just a minute to friend of the podcast, Frank Luntz, somebody who really does have his finger on the pulse of what's going on out there. He's been doing a series of very interesting focus groups for Vice News all over the country. And we always appreciate getting Frank's perspective. But two other quick issues that we've heard from the president, and we could choose from many, but on this question of facts and kind of post-truth, the post-truth approach to campaigning. First, we discovered from the president, he's said this now several times, but it first popped up at a rally, that he's about to, I guess, sign in a big new tax cut. Take a listen.
This is in addition to the very substantial tax cuts that the middle class has already gotten. So this will be a 10%. It's going to be a resolution probably introduced this week, the end of the week, or early next week.
Yeah, so we started scrambling around to find out, calling up our friends, you know, people like the Republican leadership in the House were theoretically something this would. Nobody had any idea what he was talking about.
Ways and Means Committee.
I don't know if you know this, but Congress is not in session next week or the week after. So,
even the White House Council on Economic Advisors says you're going to have to ask the president about
that. He's the one talking about that. We can't really help you out. And then the other thing was health care. And the president's done this through a series of tweets. This may be one of the hidden issues of the campaign. We were looking at Wesleyan's project, looking at political advertising, shows that health care ads are far more prevalent than any other single issue. But if you listen to the president now on this, he is saying explicitly that Democrats want to take away your coverage for pre-existing conditions. And take a listen.
We will always protect Americans with pre-existing conditions. We're going to take care of them. Some of the Democrats have been talking about ending pre-existing conditions.
So, Rick, I don't want to go into a massive history here, but let me just tell you what happened. The last president was Barack Obama. He pushed through a bill called the the Affordable Care Act, ACA, which was also called Obamacare, known as Obamacare. One of its features was to say that insurance companies would have to cover people with pre-existing conditions. The Republicans, you may have heard, were opposed to that act and actually voted several times while Obama was still president to repeal it. And then when they finally got a chance with a Republican president, they did it again. So now the president is saying that all Republicans want to cover pre-existing. I don't doubt that many do, but they have voted to repeal the bill that covers pre-existing conditions. And I have yet to meet a Democrat that's out there saying we must do away with coverage for pre-existing conditions.
Doesn't exist. There's also a lawsuit.
This is kind of like a left is right, right up is down. I mean, this is just flatly untrue.
We should mention that the official position of the Trump administration's Justice Department is that the Affordable Care Act should be declared unconstitutional, thrown out entirely because portions of it have been repealed. They have been joined on this. Actually, they joined a lawsuit by 20-some-odd attorneys general, including two who happen to be running for the Senate this year in Missouri and West Virginia, who are also using the same line about pre-existing conditions. This is an outrageous series of falsehoods that many Republicans are, to me, they're parroting the same line. It's acknowledgement that the Democrats have gotten a lot of traction on this, and they are having to play real defense. Similarly, the thing about the tax cuts, I think that's an acknowledgement that Republicans didn't get the bang for the buck. They wanted that at the tax cut. That's why they need to say, well, we got another goodie for you on the other side of the election.
All right, so look, let's just try to figure out somebody that can help us establish the truth, I think, is on the line. Dr. Frank Luntz, are you there?
I'm here, but... I already feel like I'm a tiny boulder in a huge quarry mine.
That's the way we've always thought about you. I don't know exactly what that analogy means, but that's good. We'll go with it.
Yes, I'm a small little pebble, and you guys are mountains. So
you're a tiny boulder, which is interesting. So, Frank, first of all, what's your sense? I know you were just down in you've been in Florida. Where are you right now, by the way? We always like to find it. You are never in the same place for more than a day or two.
I was in Miami last night. I was in Tampa yesterday for lunch, and right now I'm in New York City. And this time tomorrow, I should be in your great city of Washington, D.C.
So when the president comes out and he says things that are just not true, we have, because you're a language guy. We have a challenge in that as journalists, you play what the president said and then you point out that, well, that's actually not true. But we're also broadcasting and further disseminating his words, saying things that are demonstrably untrue. And then even as you point them out, our voice is never quite as strong as the president. So when the president says something like Republicans are always for covering pre-existing conditions, some Democrats are out there would like to take away pre-existing conditions. I mean, it's not actually true, but does he just get away with it? Does it matter? Do people know it's not true? Why does he do it?
The problem is in the intent of what people perceive the media. Do they perceive them as wanting to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Do they see them as kind of shifting or sliding the information or taking things out of context? Or do they see the media as making things up? Now, I am a supporter of your institution. I don't know how this country can exist as an efficient and effective democracy without the media, without the press being able to hold elected officials accountable. So whenever anyone asks me that question, I say, fair point. How much time have you spent on the fact that our unemployment rate is at genuinely historic lows, or that the growth rate, when people talked about a 3% growth rate 2 years ago, they were just condemned for making stuff up? And yet we're looking at a 4% growth rate,
Frank,
at this point.
Frank, this is like
so
classic.
That's the issue.
You think
if you're a typical Trump voter, and Rick, I know you want to get in on this, but the fact that you jump on me for stating agreed upon facts is what agitates so many people about the media. These are facts, and no one talks about them. But please go ahead.
Do you think?
Wait! Nobody talks about the unemployment rate being in. I mean, I get that. That's actually not true, Frank.
But
I mean, that's a widely when the economic report comes out, it is widely reported.
For what? 6 hours? 8 hours? And I watch this stuff, and my job is to ask voters about this stuff. And if they don't think you're reporting it, then are you? Maybe you're reporting it enough for what you want to, and I don't mean you guys personally, or even your network, but just the institution. And I have found that the people most unwilling to take any kind of constructive criticism of all professions, the people who do the most criticizing and the most accountability holding the media, is least willing to accept either criticism or accountability. But again, go ahead.
Frank, do you believe that if we put on World News Tonight stories about the booming economy, the president would stop saying things that are not true?
I believe that you would get a different reaction from viewers, because in the end, that's who you're talking to. That's who you're informing. Your sense of accountability is not just who you cover, but it's also what you report and how you report it. And every time I read the polling data, it bothers me that the credibility of the media continues to fall, whether it's Obama as president or Bush or Trump. You guys read this polling numbers, and it should be frightening to you that your profession, as is mine, is going through a crisis in credibility, and that we all need to take a look at what we do and how we do it. That's what scares me.
I, too, am scared by that, and I take all of your points, and I take them as the constructive criticism that they're intended. I would ask, what are you hearing from people in the focus groups that you're conducting? I know there's a lot of anger out there, and that's something that you've been reporting on in these Vice News focus groups. Is the anger directed in some way? Is it generalized against all of Washington, maybe all of institutions? And what does it mean to that anger to have utter falsehoods that are propagated on the campaign trail by the president?
The anger is as deep and as visceral. I cannot say that. I've never been able to say that word well. So you guys can correct me on that, but you know what I mean.
Visceral.
That's it. Yes, my tongue will not do that no matter how much I try. But it is, and the problem I have, and they edit it out because they don't want you to see actually how bad a moderator I am. But HBO and Vice have seen every one of these groups has exploded multiple times where I lose control. And I've been doing this now for 25 years. And until 2 years ago when I did it for CBS in 60 Minutes, when everyone just lost it, and it was live to tape 2 days before the election. Since that point through today, the American people have lost their sense of civility and respect. And it is about all institutions. It's about all politicians, but they always blame the other side. So it's all Democrats or all Republicans. It's all about Pelosi or all about Trump. And nobody wants to hear the other point of view. They regard the last 2 years as a chance to speak and be heard. They have not considered it a chance to keep quiet, listen, and learn.
So let's move on to where this race stands, because when we last had you on the podcast, you were pretty pessimistic on Republican chances, certainly for the House, and you thought there was a slightly, you know, obviously the map has been better in the Senate, but it seems like we've had a bit of a the perception seems to be that the tide has shifted to the Republicans here, that the Democrats still, you know, likely to take the House, but maybe very, very narrowly, and the Republicans actually possibly picking up a couple seats in the Senate. What is first of all, is that your sense of where the race stands, and what do you think is causing the movement?
That is my sense, and I think it was the Kavanaugh hearings that did it. And there's a line that was used about Yasser Arafat by an Israeli leader about 40 years ago who said that he never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And I see this with the Democrats going back to the Enron situation in the early 2000s. Once again, the challenges of the Iraqi war and the opposition of the public. Eventually, Barack Obama took a very different approach and capitalized on Republican weakness and his own willingness to speak in much more gentle terms. The visual intensity of the opposition to Brett Kavanaugh was so strong and so alarming that Republicans who up to that point thought that Congress wasn't worth anything and they weren't going to take their time to vote and they simply didn't care, and they had followed Trump's directive for 2 years that Congress was the source of the problem, not the source of the solution. But watching the Kavanaugh hearings in those last 3 or 4 days, when you had people screaming from the balconies, when you had interruptions on the floor, when you had people blocking elevators and blocking streets. And Republicans watched this. And for the first time in this election cycle, they said, wait a minute. If I don't participate, this is what I'm going to get. And I actually think it was Newt Gingrich, not Donald Trump, who came up with the line, jobs, not mobs. But, and there's something to that. The idea that these protests were so out of control, and that if Republicans stay home, this is what they're going to get for the next 2 years, that energized them. And in virtually every survey, no one changed their minds about who they're voting for. Anyone who claims that, I don't see it. But in terms of their likelihood to vote, Republicans and Democrats are almost identical today. Go back 45 days, and Democrats had a huge 10 to 15 point advantage. That in itself has changed a few Senate races. In Texas, I'll be specific. In Texas and Tennessee, in Texas, where the Democrat had come almost even, now people are looking at about a 10-point gap for the Republican, Ted Cruz. In Tennessee, Marsha Blackburn had been losing to a very moderate Democrat for the entire election cycle. Now she's up 5 or 6 points in every survey. It hasn't had an impact in every state. North Dakota was dead even 45 days ago. Now the Democrat seems to be tanking. I think it did have an impact in Republican-leaning states, which is why the GOP will pick up some seats in the Senate. I still see the Democrats with a double-digit advantage over Republicans when all the votes are counted in the House.
And Frank, I think you're right about this not being about undecided voters or you know, changeable voters at this point. It's about getting your base out. How does the caravan make its way into this? It strikes me that this was not... This would not necessarily be an issue that would be apolitical or even be covered at this stage necessarily, if not for the president giving it a megaphone. This is a caravan of migrants. This happens from time to time. This is larger than most. It's also many, many hundreds of miles away from the U.S. border. These are people that are coming here, by all accounts, trying to seek asylum at the border, which is a legal thing to do. The president has cast it as if it's a marauding band of criminals about to overrun the borders. But how does that play into your calculations for how these next 13 days play out?
Well, it depends. Are they going to reach the border in time?
In time for the election, you mean?
Yes.
No.
And they won't? Then no. I think it's going to be less important than it could have been, or less consequential. I know what happens when you get border skirmishes. I've done a fair amount of work in the Middle East, and I watched how significant. Now, a lot of people died there, but the border skirmish between Israel and the Palestinians at Gaza became the biggest issue across the globe for 72 hours, and that was manufactured. There would not have been that border violence if the Palestinian government had not promoted it, pushed it, advocated for it, and lie to its people about what the consequence would be.
Hey, by the way, on that, I think our border is a little different than Gaza.
I agree with that, yeah. But this could be significant. This could. What happens when you get there? What happens?
Well, we've had these caravans behind that. They come up there and they ask for asylum. We don't have clashes. We don't have people. You know, they don't all. They go to the border crossings. By all accounts, they're headed towards Tijuana. This is not the small groups that come running across the, you know, in between the border crossings. They'll come up and ask for asylum, and they'll be processed. I think the last group, it was a small percentage that ultimately got granted asylum. But Frank, can I ask you? I know we have to let you go because you've been already very generous with your time. But on these allegations that we've heard from, you know, Mike Pence saying that the Venice left-wing groups started this caravan and Venezuela is funding it, and then the president saying and Democrats. I mean, how does the president of the United States come out and accuse Democrats of funding and organizing this caravan without? It's not enough to say there isn't evidence. It's not true.
Do we not have issues at the border? Do we not have?
No, we do have issues at the border. But they carry. I mean, because there's issues at the borders, he can make something up about Nancy Pelosi, funding a caravan. I mean, I just don't get it.
So let's go back to the perspective. 46-47%
unemployment
voted for Donald Trump.
So we go to the unemployment rate? I mean,
and they're listening to this conversation. Yeah. I heard some of your conversation before you came to me.
Yep.
And what they'll think of is this is a podcast designed just to bash the president.
No, it's a podcast to try to get at the truth, and we will call out untruths on all sides.
But you have to have
a set of facts. You know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
I've used that quote many, many times, and I will tell you that it only got me a B+ when I used it at the University of Pennsylvania. If you want to be effective, then you talk about the issues of border security, that 11 million people are here without having done it the right way, and that Americans are legitimately concerned about how people become citizens, how they are accounted for, and acknowledge that the process has not worked. Then you get to, and here's the latest example of it. But if you're listening to this broadcast, and I urge you to go back and do a content analysis of it.
We do. We do an extensive post-game review of everything. And we have to often go back and correct Rick a little bit. But yeah.
But then I suggest, that's very funny, then I suggest that you guys go back and count the number of seconds that you're critical of the president. Count the number of seconds where you acknowledge that this is an issue, put it up against each other, and share that with your audience. That will make this, which is already a brilliant podcast, it'll make it even better, because you'll be doing what you criticize the president for not doing, which is you'll be holding yourselves accountable.
All right, so
if you're going to do it with him, you should do it with yourselves too, and me, by the way.
We will definitely do it with you, Frank. There's no question. So on your way out the door, percentage chance the Democrats take the Senate is?
20%.
Percentage chance that the Republicans hang on to the House is?
10%.
Percentage chance that the Dodgers beat the Red Sox in the World Series is?
I was waiting for that question. I do not know, but the percentage chance that Frank Luntz will be sitting in everyone's shot for games 4 and 5. Let's just do game 4.
It may not be a five
at this rate, man.
We will see what happens, but I promise that I will be wearing some sort of statement in that shot for all of your podcast listeners to view.
Ooh, that is intriguing.
It's the red team against the blue team. What is that? What does that mean, Frank? We got an issue here, Frank.
Frank Luntz.
I wonder who you guys will be supporting. I guess we will learn when you guys spend 20 minutes criticizing the Red Sox and 1 minute criticizing the Dodgers, then we'll know what side you're on.
Screw the Red Sox. I don't like the Dodgers either, but I'm a Dodgers fan this week.
Okay. I'm agnostic. All right, thank you. Rick, Frank Luntz, adios. Thank you for joining us.
And John, that'll be the last time you're ever agnostic in anything in your life.
All right, thank you. All right, you know what? We do have to take a quick break because we have our sponsors who have a very quick word. When we come back, we want to do a quick check-in with one of our favorite reporters, Rachel Bade, over at Politico, about the 10% prospect that Frank Luntz just raised, Republicans holding the House. We'll be back in just a minute.
You see headlines across your screen all day, but you're busy. What do you need to know? What's actually shaping your world? I'm Brad Milkey from ABC News, and every morning we start here.
It was extraordinary for us watching here in Singapore.
This is ABC's new daily podcast, a handful of stories, just 20 minutes.
Director Comey, thanks for being with us.
Newsmakers, smart reporting, taking you straight to the heart of the story. Start here. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
All right, welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are joined now by Rachel Bade, political reporter for Politico. Thank you for joining us.
Happy to be on the program.
So you had an article that caught our eyes, why we called you up, about prospects for Republicans actually hanging on to the House, which would be, even if they lost 20 seats in the process, would actually be a tremendous victory, and contrary to the historic trend for midterm elections, obviously.
Right.
First of all, I want to explore with you quickly two things. First, how that could happen, and then we want to ask you the harder question: is what would they do with a 2 or 3 seat majority? but how realistic is that scenario that they somehow managed to pull a rabbit out of the hat here and hang on to the House?
It's definitely unlikely, but the whole thing about this story was that it's not impossible, right? The narrative right now is that Dems are easily going to flip the House. But there is a path for Republicans, albeit a very narrow one. And that's, we sort of heard chatter about this tick up after Republicans started experiencing this post-Brett Kavanaugh bump. Basically, Trump's approval rating has gone up, and the congressional ballot has tightened. Democrats still lead by something like 9 points nationwide. But if you actually look at the battleground districts that matter, the Democrats' edge on the congressional ballot has pretty much disappeared. And a lot of that is because there's been this enthusiasm boost on the right. And that's why you hear the president talking about all of these red meat issues right now, like immigration, tax cuts, trying to sort of keep that energy going. But Democrats, they have to flip 24 seats now to take over the House. And that is because Republicans have actually, it looks like they're going to pick up a rare Democratic seat in Minnesota. So the number now is 24, not 23. Both sides have basically admitted to me that Democrats have about 15 of them on lock, meaning they're halfway there to that 24. But Democrats are competing right now in 75 GOP held districts. So they have a whole different way, a whole different bunch of different paths that they can take to sort of win back this majority. The question is, you know, is this enthusiasm we're seeing on the right enough? I do think it's really unlikely, but again, it's not impossible.
And Rachel, the president has had, shall we say, a complicated relationship with congressional leadership over the last couple of years, as you've been covering. The president is in Wisconsin, scheduled to be in Wisconsin today. We're told that House Speaker Paul Ryan will be alongside him. It seems like there's a metaphor there in the kind of the togetherness of the party. Ted Cruz, Lion Ted, no more, according to what he told John Carl. Now
beautiful
Ted. How have Republican leaders internalized President Trump and his leadership in this last stretch? Is the calculation, is the play, you got to get as close as you can to the president because whatever he's doing, it works?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded, you know, you talk about this rally in Wisconsin with Paul Ryan of the time Paul Ryan disinvited Trump when he was a candidate and the Access Hollywood video had just come out. You know, they were supposed to rally together that next day, and Ryan was considering withdrawing his endorsement of the president. He had to be talked down by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who's good buds with the president now. But yeah, since then, things have totally changed, and Republicans are very much leaning into and hugging Trump as much as they can because they think that's the only way they can turn out their base. It's the only way they can get people who turned out in 2016 to vote for Trump back to the polls in a midterm election, and they need these people to show up. So I do think it's interesting, you know, they're sort of going along with a lot of this caravan rhetoric, which I kind of wonder if it's going to have a backlash in some of these GOP-held districts with large Hispanic populations. They have to be careful about that. But they're really leaning into immigration because they feel they have a leg up on this when it comes to the nation's security and fighting crime. This whole thing with a 10% tax cut that the president started talking about earlier this week, let's be honest, nobody in Congress knew what the heck he was talking about. Republicans have definitely talked about doing another tax cut that would basically make permanent some temporary breaks that they passed last year, but nobody's talking about a 10% tax cut in the lame duck. But again, right now it's just about winning for them, and so they're just following his lead, even though they'd probably rather talk about the economy right now than some of these other things.
So I know you have to go, but the other thing I wanted to touch on briefly is what a Republican-controlled House looks like. Because again, you've already said that they're halfway there in terms of Democrats, you know, basically races they've locked in. Most of the other races that are being contested are Republican seats. So if the Republicans cling to their majority, it's going to be what, like a 2 or 3 seat majority? How does that look? I mean, how does we've seen the troubles that Paul Ryan had with his narrow majority. So how does it look with where any two or three Republicans, maybe even a single Republican, can kind of, you know, hold the keys to the control of the House floor?
Yeah, it's going to be a total disaster. Kevin McCarthy, who had wanted to be speaker before Paul Ryan, he ran for the position when John Boehner was ousted. He came up short because conservatives, you know, don't like him. They don't trust him. They don't see him as a real Republican with sort of, you know, these values that they espouse on things like immigration. He is going to run for speaker if Republicans keep the House. And a lot of people do not think he's going to be able to lock down those 218 votes he would need for that position, which would put us in this sort of this power vacuum sort of situation where no one knows who is going to be the next speaker. And that could go on for literally weeks. We could see Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, try to run against him, throw his hat into the ring. Jim Jordan, who is obviously the darling of the far right, the House Freedom Caucus leader, he's going to try for the position. It would be total chaos for a long while, I think, in the Republican conference. But again, they have struggled over the past 2 years to get anything done with their current 240-plus seat majority because the conference is so divided between conservatives and moderates and establishment and Trump-type Republicans that them getting anything passed with a three or four seat majority is just impossible.
You have to have near total unity, which is something that they've just not had anywhere near.
They would probably have to turn to Democrats to get anything done. They'd have to have a more bipartisan chamber, and the far right would just go, you know, AWOL on that because that's the exact opposite of what they want right now.
All right, Rachel Bade with Politico. Thank you for joining us here on Power House Politics. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much.
So Rick, that is an interesting thing. If you, I mean, we're getting into what Frank put it at 10%, yeah. But if you had the you know, a two or three seat, four seat, whatever it is, one seat Republican majority, you're never going to please all those hardcore Freedom Caucus guys. And if you do, you're going to lose the handful of moderates that are left. So does that mean you basically have a coalition government in the House? Is that what you would need? Who gets 218 votes?
I think whoever gets 218 votes is whoever Donald Trump wants to get 218 votes.
So
I think
Donald Trump christens
Donald
the
Trump,
leader.
I think, gets an outsized role in choosing the next House Speaker.
So he's the Speaker of the House.
I think he is able to dictate the terms of that.
That does not sound like a coalition government. Where
no, I don't think that's. I think
partisan.
What would they rally behind other than Donald Trump at that point? I think that would be the only thing that could make that group cohesive. And he were to say, look, my man Kevin McCarthy or my man Steve Scalise is the guy to do it.
My
he doesn't do that
Jim
right
Jordan.
Away. My Jim Jordan, I think that person becomes the next speaker. Jim Jordan, maybe less so. But I think that
my
person.
My man Ted Yoho.
You go for it. And we haven't even talked about what the meltdown would be on the Democratic side. I mean, the calamitous situation.
Oh, after losing
that
have, this
if they did, if they
layup.
Did not,
yeah.
If they fell short after this. You'd have
there
to imagine
were, oh my God,
house
the
cleaning at the top. I mean,
oh
we've
my
got
God.
We know the issues with leadership and the three people who've been leading the Democratic side for more than a decade now.
Do they go left? Do they go center? What do they do?
Or do they go out? I mean, I think you'd be talking about something of a house cleaning at the very time that the Democrats start turning to 2020. It would be a fascinating scenario.
All right. Well, an unlikely scenario, but not one that's in. I mean, I would say it's. From this vantage point, it doesn't look any more unlikely than a Donald Trump victory in 2016 looked at this point before that election. So who knows? All right, that is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. Thank you for listening. Thank you to our incredible Powerhouse Politics team, Trevor Hastings, Avery Miller, Angie Yak, the entire team. And we will be back next week or maybe before.